All right, let me go on and talk about another argument, another design argument. Well, it's related to design. The moral argument. So we've talked about cosmological design, a species of design, mind arguments. Now I want to talk about the moral argument. Now, the moral argument is extremely poignant and potent, I think, because some of this is pretty abstruse. The nature of mind, substances, properties, property dualism, substance dualism. We could even get into supervenience and emergentism and a lot of very complicated things. But everyone has a sense of morality. Everyone does, to some degree or another. Even sociopaths absolutize themselves as the source of morality. So they still have some kind of moral principle. What I want is law. Now, it's wrong, but it's a moral principle. So if we can connect the moral sense, or let's put it this way, the conscience, strongly with God, if we can argue that the existence of an objective moral order is best explained by God, a personal and moral God, a lawgiver and judge, than by anything else, we have an argument that immediately relates to the subjectivity of human beings. Now, Moreland's chapter deals not only with the meaning of moral statements, but the meaning of life in general. We want to talk about that. You might talk about existential meaning, personal meaning, cosmic meaning, or universal meaning, and how morality and our moral statements fits into that. You might remember that C.S. Lewis spends the first several chapters of Mere Christianity giving a moral argument for the existence of God. And that's no accident. It's because it's something that connects with people very quickly, very easily, at least a sense of morality. Now, of course, to make these arguments work, you have to diffuse and dismantle relativism. Because if relativism is true, there is no objective, absolute, universal morality. So we're not accountable to a higher moral law. Morality is constructed and it may be deconstructed. So you can't use the moral argument unless you have already argued against relativism. So certainly please keep that in mind. But even those people who are relativists may still struggle with a larger sense of meaning or significance or value. And J.P. talks about Albert Camus' statement that the ultimate question in philosophy is whether or not one should commit suicide. That is life worth living? If so, why? If not, why not? Where do we fit into the larger scheme of things? Does our own sense of value and meaning relate to anything else? Is there any common moral meaning? Is there any significance to life if we're simply dead when we're dead? Now, I put this in an essay I handed out earlier from Aldous Huxley. Huxley, in one of his books, says that he and his friends desired that life have no meaning so they could create their own meaning and resist any kind of moralism. Now, there are some people that struggle and wrestle with a sense of cosmic meaninglessness, valuelessness. Where does it all fit in? Where do I fit into the larger picture of things? But some people seem to take the idea of meaninglessness as a license for freedom. That is, if there is no objective meaning, moral or otherwise, then I can create my own meaning. I don't have to worry about sexual restraint or moral restraint in any sense. And he has a very telling quote from one of his books to that effect. So with the larger question of meaning, some people seem to struggle to find a larger sense of meaning because it eludes them. And others, in a sense, seem quite happy with meaninglessness. And this is the postmodernist stance. Huxley was before postmodernism. But some postmodernists say, no, there is no objectively given meaning, the meaning of humanity, the meaning of community, the meaning of the state. Nothing is binding. Nothing is normative. That's all part of the modernist project. So now we just play with the broken pieces of a failed project, and we cobble it together any way we want. There's no game plan. There's no blueprint. It's all contingent. It's all negotiable. It can be constructed and deconstructed, invented and reinvented. There are no foundations to anything. It's all just a play of surfaces. But we need to spend a little bit of time talking about the meaning of moral statements, because whatever people's take is on the universe and meaning, people speak and they use words that relate to morality. So the question is, given your speech, given things that are written down, what is the meaning of these moral statements? So we're dealing here with what is called meta-ethics. This concerns the justification of moral statements within a worldview. Now, what do I mean by that, the justification of moral statements within a worldview? Remember I said earlier that people need to be accountable for what they say. People need to be held responsible for their worldview. So people can claim things that don't fit their worldview. That is, their worldview is internally contradictory. So we all make moral statements. We all have moral hunches or moral commitments. What grounds them? Remember we said you can make a statement, but it's only true if it corresponds to reality. Well, the same is true of moral statements. Simply making a moral statement does not make it true or make it advisable or imperative. So this is really a great place to prod people and poke people. Again, we've got to try to show that there is an objective morality and that this morality is better explained by theism than an alternative worldview. It's the same structure as the mind argument, right? A two-stage kind of an argument. You've got to get rid of relativism, show there's an objective moral order that's binding on us, then how do you explain it? How do you account for it? How do you understand the meaning of moral terms? And the relationship of human beings as moral actors in the cosmos. That's the larger issue. So we've got to go through some theories that try to really dispense with an objective and transcendent moral law. The first one is called emotivism. This is sometimes called the boo hooray theory of morality. That morality is nothing but emotional utterances. It's not factual. This is one of the two non-cognitive theories. Emotivism. Abortion, boo. Or abortion, hooray, freedom of choice. And that's it. It's like cheering at a sports event. Another one, very similar, also non-cognitive, is called imperativalism, or the just-do-it approach. Now remember from our discussion of propositions that an imperative is not a proposition. If I say, turn your paper in on time, that doesn't specify any state of affairs. It's an injunction. It's a command. I'm enjoining you to do it. I'm calling you to fulfill a state of affairs. I'm calling you to fulfill certain conditions that will cause a state of affairs. That is, turn in the paper. But an imperative alone is not a proposition. So some people want to reduce moral statements to imperatives, kind of floating in a cognitive void. So people shouldn't have abortions. Why? Because people shouldn't have abortions. It's not an explanation. You're just repeating an imperative. People should be free to have abortions. Why? Because people should be free to have abortions. You're not explaining anything. You're just repeating an imperative. Or if you say, you know, I hate abortion, or I hate homosexuality, well, that's just emotivism. And you can easily combine the two. I hate it and you shouldn't do it. Why? Because I hate it and you shouldn't do it. Now, you know, when you get people on both sides, like people who go to the Capitol and get in each other's face with their signs, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, screaming at each other, not a lot of philosophical discourse is going on. And sadly, a lot of American culture is in that category. But moral judgments are much more than statements of feeling. Moral judgments are indicative of a reflection on states of affairs. If you are angry that there are 1.3 million abortions in America a year, and there'll be more if John Kerry's elected, if you're angry about that, why? You have a moral argument should be that the vast majority of abortions are morally wrong. What kind of language is that? It's propositional language. Are morally wrong. It's not merely an emotive utterance. Now, you may be emotional about it. You may not be emotional about it. There are things that you take to be wrong that you don't particularly get emotional about. I think if you destroy an anthill for fun, that it's wrong. But I'm not deeply grieved in my spirit over the ants, you know? Big deal. There are a lot of them out there. But I still think it's morally wrong to just destroy an anthill for fun. But I have no real emotional connection to that, right? Moreover, you can be very emotional about things that are amoral, such as sporting events. Intensely emotional, passionate. The outcome is amoral. So you can't make emotion the defining feature of moral statements. Now, imperatives. Imperatives are also rooted in propositions. We should say, we should make, as President Bush says, we should make the least of these welcome in our society. So we don't create embryos and kill them for stem cells. So we don't allow partial birth abortions. So we have the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. So if you kill a woman who's pregnant and the baby dies as well, it's two homicides. Or if you kill only the baby and not the mother, it's one homicide. Why? Because you value human life as having certain properties. So the imperatives are really related to judgments on states of affairs. I mean, if these non-cognitive views were correct, you could have no moral education. No one could change their mind by going from less informed to more informed on moral principles, because it's non-cognitive. It's a matter of emotion and a matter of imperative. But emotions should be rightly calibrated to moral realities, and imperatives should rightly connect with moral realities. So these theories take elements of a healthy moral life and divorce them from their living center, which is cognitivity, ideas, judgments on states of affairs. All right, you with me on that? All right, there are cognitive theories, private subjectivism, and cultural relativism. We've already dealt with relativism, certainly. Here, you are simply stating your own viewpoint, so it's cognitive, but the question is, why do you have your viewpoint? I mean, I think this is wrong, and I think it's a property of myself that I'm claiming that this is wrong, but does it connect with anything else? That's the real question, because if you say, S is P, you know, this subject has this property. That's not a statement about you. That's a statement about properties and their relationship to other states of affairs, right? So if you say, you know, it's my personal private feeling that this is wrong, well, how does that feeling make it wrong objectively? So there's something certainly wrong here. We've already dealt with relativism. Now, you've got objectivist theories. Ethical naturalism, this is an interesting view, is that you have natural properties and you try to make them ethical. Moreover, you might say, an act is right if it's approved of by most people. Yeah. Well, one's cognitive and one's non-cognitive. Emotivism is just your emotive response. Private subjectivism is more analyzing your internal states cognitively. They're both bankrupt. They're just bankrupt in different ways. But an objective theory like utilitarianism might say what's right is what gives pleasure to the most people, or something like that, roughly. Gives the most pleasure to the most people, the most happiness to the most people. There are various ways of cashing it out. Or you might say what is right is reducible to what is conducive to survival. A lot of Darwinists say this. They try to make a descriptive claim about Darwinism into a normative claim about survivability. Okay? Now, the question is, what makes you think that a majority of people are right, or a majority of people constitute a moral property? I mean, just do a thought experiment. What if some bizarre cosmic rays came over the Earth and 90% of the population thought torturing the innocent for pleasure was good, and 10% retained their moral sense? Would torturing the innocent for pleasure then become good because the majority of people believe it? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Or survival. Well, that's just notoriously vague. Survive in what conditions? Survive for how long? Who survives? Who dies? What exactly is the goal here? Is it mere longevity? Is it longevity for one group over another? Moreover, mere longevity doesn't seem to be ethically rich enough, because there may be cases where you should sacrifice your life for another person, even if that other person only lives for a few years. There may be situations like that. So this doesn't seem to work. It's objective, and that's good. You're trying to find some objective property that's natural, that grounds ethics, but it doesn't really do the trick. People can approve of actions that are wrong. They may approve of actions that are wrong. They may not approve of actions that are right. I think we just can give counterexamples. I mean, in India, for many years, sati was legal, and it was very built into the cultural system. That is where a woman is burned alive on her husband's funeral pyre. It was very tied up in the culture and the religion for hundreds of years. And when the British colonized India, those horrible, terrible imperialists stomped it out. They said, this is wrong. Should not be done. Think of Chinese foot binding. Went on for centuries in China. There are many examples. Things are deeply culturally embedded that I think right-thinking people will say were quite wrong. Okay. Now, another view, which is an objectivist, is ethical non-naturalism. And this is basically getting into the right category, is that there are irreducible moral facts. They are not material states of affairs. They exist as parts of the universe. Some things are right, some things are wrong, whatever the majority thinks, whatever the culture may say. Now, of course, on a Christian view, God possesses moral properties and attributes, and God's nature made known through his will determines what's right, and human beings have moral properties that are not reducible to physical properties. We have a soul. Our soul has value. We have value as an embodied being as well. And we should be treated differently than the rest of creation because of who we are. So some kind of moral, or rather ethical, non-naturalism seems to make the most sense. Because, as we talked about earlier, moral values are not empirical objects. They're real. They're known through intuition, largely. But they are not reducible to natural states. So, when we go back to moral statements, infanticide is wrong. What makes it wrong? It's not because you're emotional. It's not because you used an imperative. It's not because you introspected and found your true feelings. It's not because of some objective property, like most people think it's wrong or will survive better if it is eliminated. It is wrong if it is true. If it's true that infanticide is morally wrong, it's true because that statement relates to an objective, non-natural state of affairs. Okay, now you might say, what do you mean by non-natural? I mean, if someone is killed, if a young child is killed in a partial birth abortion, even though she is viable, and they all are in partial birth abortions, I hope you know, then those are natural states of affairs. But we're talking about the moral judgment. The moral judgment is not reading off natural properties, like the baby was 6 pounds, the baby had this quality, the mother had this quality. It's a moral statement about a physical state of affairs. And also immaterial as well, because the mother and the child both have souls. But by ethical non-naturalism, we mean that there are moral values that are not reducible to physical states, but they're applicable to evaluating physical states. Are you with me on that? All right. Questions or comments so far about the meaning of moral language, metaethics? We'll come back to metaethics and how God relates to the good and relates to our knowledge of the good. But questions about these theories? I haven't gone through all the critique of them, just some of the critique. Yes? Well, for one thing, I don't think the women are killing themselves. I think they're being executed. There's a wild book I read many years ago by Mary Daly, where she looks at the literature of anthropology about sati. And she's a radical pagan feminist, but she has some very good insights in this book. And she says that it's written from a male perspective that the women just gleefully go along with this. And that's unlikely. It's unlikely for anyone to gleefully go along with being burned alive, no matter what your culture is, no matter what the background is. Well, it's kind of an interesting argument because they're arguing that it's better for the person to be killed than to be ostracized. So it's obviously wrong for them to be ostracized as well. So why not argue this whole society should be reformed to honor human beings, including widows? That seems to be where the argument should go. Right? Yes? Yeah, it's an argument for the quality of life without the sanctity of life. It's basically an ethical naturalism, that life only has value if it is felt value by either the person or the society at large. And usually it's society at large, especially when you get into euthanasia, because someone may want to live. But it may be that supposedly the rest of society says, you know, you're not productive anymore, you're not useful anymore, and it'd be better off for all of us if you were dead. They might say, but I want to live. Well, we know better than you do. So it's the opinion of the many opposed to the value of the individual. So it's a quality of life determined through some sociological sample or some legal theory, as opposed to an intrinsic, irreducible sanctity of life that is given, that is ontological. See, that's a biblical view of creation and objective value and the worth of human beings. And that's being systematically undermined in our culture in many, many ways. But it's oftentimes not put very clearly because people don't think oftentimes in terms of ethical theories. They just make pronouncements and get lobbies behind them and try to get candidates elected and vilify the people on the other side. There's not a lot of ethical discourse in our culture today. You may have noticed that. And I hope we can bring ethical discourse back to the table and also bring back some fundamental questions about moral value. What is moral value? What would make a statement you utter about morality true or false? If you utter a statement, it doesn't make it true. What makes a statement true about morality? That's a really good question for a non-Christian. You may have very strong moral feelings. What makes those moral feelings true about the universe? I bet a lot of people have never thought about that. They just thought, I've had these moral feelings. Good for you. What makes them true? What makes them meaningful? Anything else on this, these theories? Yeah. You want to get me started?
Yeah.
All right, I'm started. All right.
What I believe to be morally true, but the matter of faith, that
Yes, right. Talk about a divided field of thinking. You know, and those of you who have read your Schaefer, the idea of the upper story is faith, meaning, significance. The lower story is sort of science, facts, material states. And there's a tremendous dichotomy between the two. And the upper story is just a blind leap of faith. It can't be argued. It can't be supported. John Kerry on abortion in the last debate. Talk about a divided field of cognition. I mean, it's pathetic to think about it. But I want to articulate this. This is very important to apologetics, American culture, public policy, and the fate of America. I'm serious. He says, first of all, to the pro-life person that asked the question, who had a very good and sharp question, can you assure me that there will never be federal funds spent on abortion in your administration? I believe that was the question. First of all, you know, I deeply feel for your religious conviction. And I am a religious person, too. I'm Catholic. Was raised Catholic. I was an altar boy. Well, that's reason to watch out already, but we'll just waive that. And I deeply respect your view. But now get this. He didn't say it in the debate, but he said it previously. He says, I believe that human life begins at conception. He has said that publicly, I believe, several times. Geraldine Ferraro said that 20 years ago. She was running for vice president with Mondale. Now, what that claim is, I believe that in the universe, human beings come into existence at conception. Human beings. He doesn't make the human person distinction. Human beings come into existence at conception. I believe that is a fact about the universe, but that's my faith. And I can't impose that on other people who believe differently. And by the end of that answer, he was saying this, that everyone in America has the right for federal funds for an abortion. A constitutional right for federal funds for an abortion. That was the conclusion of his answer when he says that human life begins at conception. And he believes that as a Catholic. Well, I think our Archbishop here has got it right. You vote for him and you're Catholic, it's a sin. You vote for him and you're a Christian, it's a sin. Just on that basis. But just bracket that for a moment. But just think. Of the double-mindedness going on here. You see, the whole purpose of apologetics is we can know God as God is revealed in the Bible and through Christ. We can know God. What is knowledge? Come on, knowledge. Justified true belief. Can you give arguments for justified true beliefs? Yes. Kerry says, I can't impose that on anyone else. Kerry, all law is the imposition of morality. All law. And his law that he would bring about, appointing nothing but pro-life Supreme Court justices, nothing but pro-abortion Supreme Court justices, nothing but pro-death, pro-abortion federal judges, and he could appoint hundreds of them, federally fund abortions, not oppose partial birth abortion, be against the Unborn Victim of Violence Act, that's an imposition of a moral system on America. And he's a Catholic, and he believes life begins at conception. But he would dare not impose that morality, but he will impose the most liberal pro-death agenda you can imagine on the entire country. Now, folks, if that is not insane, idiotic double-mindedness, I don't know what is. And someone who has that kind of divided sense of reality and is that disconnected from his own faith and from logic and from reasoning has no business being president of the United States, has no business being a senator, has no business being a congressman, has no business being a mayor, has no business being a dog catcher, has no business being a high school teacher. Can anybody say amen? I mean, did anybody else pick up on this? This is moral insanity. It is moral insanity. It's your fault. Yes. I was jamming. You always hit a few wrong notes. Did anybody else think about that during the debate? How insane that answer was? And a lot of people just swallow it without a thought. Oh, yes, we have our personal private religious convictions. Keep them private. Keep them tucked away. don't bring them into the public realm. You know, there's this old joke about Ted Kennedy. His religious beliefs are so personal and private, he would never impose them on anybody, even himself. It's really a strange situation in America today. Now, part of what we have to do as apologists is bring out these things. Because a lot of the problem that we have as Christians in America today is that, as Dallas Willard puts it and J.P. Moreland put it, we're not viewed as representing a tradition of knowledge. We're viewed as simply having private, emotional beliefs that are entirely private and personal and should not relate to public discourse, or only relate in a very general, usually pretty insipid way. Very general kind of civil religion type comments. But it's amazing when you see someone trying to work both sides against the middle, right? That, you know, I'm religious, America's religious, this is not Europe. But, of course, religion can have absolutely no implications for public policy. And all those Americans who are pro-life have no say. If I'm elected president, this president. I could go on and on about that guy for other reasons. But, I mean, just think about the argument that he gave. It is morally insane. You trust that kind of a person with the future of America for the next 4 to 8 years? Think about it. For God's sake, for America's sake, think about it. We need to go through 4 defective views of meaning and morality. But before that, one of the students reminded me of a good reductio ad absurdum argument you can use against people who say that religiously I believe that, let's say, abortion is wrong, but I wouldn't impose it. You substitute terms and make it into a reductio ad absurdum argument. So you say something like, well, I think that Jews are human beings with full human rights, but some people don't, and some people want to put them in concentration camps and kill them, and who am I to impose my morality on those people? Or some people think there should not be slavery, that Africans are as much humans as we are and they have as many rights as we do, but who am I to impose my religious view of human beings made in the image and likeness of God on some people who don't have that similar view or have a different religious view which says that God has ordained some people to be slaves? You see what a terrible argument is? I mean, it's just terrible at every possible level. I have an explanation for why I chose dog catcher above high school teacher. I thought of it. I was going through elected offices, and then I went to non-elected offices. All right. Now. Okay. Let's talk about defective views of meaning and morality, 4 naturalistic theories. One is the universe itself has no meaning, was not designed to fulfill any moral purpose, but human beings appear on the scene and have a moral sense, have moral feelings. You have a quote, and this is sufficient. You have a quote here from Paul Kurtz on page 120 of Moreland. The humanist maintains as his first principle that life is worth living, at least that it can be found to have worth. The universe is neutral, indifferent to man's existential yearnings, but we instinctively discover life, experience its throb. I want to ontologically parse that throb. Experience its throb, its excitement, its attraction. Life is here to be lived, enjoyed, suffered, and endured. Later, Kurtz makes this point. One cannot prove this normative principle to everyone's satisfaction. Living beings tend instinctively to maintain themselves and to reproduce their own kind. This is the primordial fact of life. It is precognitive and pre-rational and is beyond ultimate justification. It is a brute fact of our contingent natures. It is an instinctive desire to live. So, Kurtz says, no, we have a sense of meaning and purpose, and we have a moral sense about things, but it's not echoed by the universe, as it were. It's not a part of the design plan of a creator who has built it into us to recognize objectively good, objectively bad states, so that some things are meaningful and some things are less meaningful. It's merely subjective. And he says it's pre-rational, can't be proven, it's precognitive, it's basically just what? Just is, what's the term for that? A brute fact. So instead of trying to explain it, he just says it doesn't need to be explained. And this is what naturalists do repeatedly. With the universe, the collection of contingent states, Russell says it's just there. Our sense of value, whether it's aesthetic, moral, any kind of axiological statement, statements of value, it's just part of who we are. And somehow that's sufficient. Well, that's denying that there could be a deeper, better, richer explanation. Moreover, the question then becomes what? About this throb. What is this throb that's supposed to be sufficient for giving you meaning? He's a naturalist. He doesn't believe in God. It's just there. Well, it's a desire to experience and a desire to reproduce that's merely there. You're reducible to material, physical states. You don't have a distinct soul. You were not designed with any moral or any aesthetic purpose whatsoever. So the throb is merely a subjective state. Well, how about Osama's throb? Hitler's throb? Mother Teresa's throb? Martin Luther King's throb? How do you distinguish between throbs? They all have different throbs. How do you evaluate them? Rank them, rate them, evaluate them. You can't. Yes?
My sister is very much a proponent of everything as a reflection of positive energy. And so to her, it's like this level of positivity or positive happiness or goodness, or it's almost emotivism.
Cosmic emotivism.
Mm-hmm. She takes it very seriously, and she says it's the positive energy of everybody else coming together and creating positive energy that actually sustains life.
Well, then you have to define what's positive and what's not. And to do that, you have to have some principle above the mere phenomena. You know, I bet those 19 hijackers were absolutely elated before they all died. They pulled off the most amazing act of terrorism in the history of the world. And they knew it right before they died. They had to do so many different things to pull that thing off. So many things had to go right. They planned it for years. I'm sure they were absolutely elated. They're also elated about what was supposed to come afterwards. What's positive? What's negative? Is it mere elation, emotion? It's got to be deeper than that. And if it's deeper than that, it's moral. And then you have to ask, what is a moral state of affairs? What makes something a moral state of affairs, a good moral state of affairs? What makes something a bad moral state of affairs? A lot of people get a lot of mileage out of language that doesn't go very far. I mean, I can wax Wittgensteinian here, I suppose. With New Age people, language goes on holiday all the time. Because they talk about, you know, positive energy and building positive energy without really defining what it means or stipulating the difference between good and evil, or worse yet, trying to deny evil even exists. That evil is just a lack of awareness of what's positive and what's happy. So, you know, according to Kurtz, you just have this feeling of meaning, and it's inexplicable, it's absurd, it's a brute fact, and furthermore, how do you evaluate principles, moral principles, on that basis, if it's non-cognitive or pre-rational? What's your standard? Now, Kurtz was one of the principal authors of the Humanist Manifesto number 2. And in that document, which came out, I think, in 1972, he said, ethics is autonomous and situational. So it depends on human beings, not on God, and it's relative to the situation. So it's individual or cultural relativism. That's all he's left with. So the throb takes various forms, and there's nothing above the throb to evaluate it. So he's then stuck with all the problems of cultural and individual relativism. That's what Moreland calls temporal purpose and optimistic humanism.